This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you. Aloha, and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. The aloha is because right now I am in Hawaii. I'm sitting on the balcony of our hotel looking at palm trees and tourists everywhere, and it's, man, I just love Hawaii, and the beach is amazing here. We rented scooters, we were scooting all over the place, and Beartooth, our best friends, have this crazy Airbnb on the beach, so we're just having a wild time here in Hawaii, and man, like, we got to do the Silvertooth thing, which is when Silverstein and Beartooth, we get together, we play shows, and we just have a wild time playing songs together. So it was awesome, and man, I just couldn't be in a better mood. And not just because I'm in Hawaii, but because this episode of the podcast is 100% my favorite. Today we have a fucking legend on the show, Mr. Dennis Lixon of Refused. I don't even know where to start. I mean, without Dennis, I would have never started screaming in a band. I know a lot of other people who feel the same way. When they heard the Refused record, The Shape of Punk to Come, it literally changed what I thought about punk rock, what I thought about hardcore music, heavy music, whatever you want to call it at that time. So talking to him, being able to go onto his tour bus and sit in the back with him for an hour and pick his brain was just the most incredible experience for me. Before we jump in, if you want to get in touch, if you got suggestions for the show, if you want to tell me I'm awesome or I'm not so awesome, please, please feel free to get in touch. You can email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Snapchat. It's Real Shane Told. I'm pretty good at getting back to people on Snapchat, so check that out. We also got Twitter, @leadsingersyn, S-Y-N, and there is an Instagram account as well, @leadsingersyndrome. Also, if you want to support the show, super easy. If you buy things online, if you use Amazon, please use our Amazon affiliate link. Just go to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. It takes you right to the Amazon homepage. Login is normal, and anything you buy, we get 4%. So again, that's leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. Also, if you can write a review on iTunes, that really helps the show, helps us grow. And just tell a friend, you know, if you have a friend that likes music, that's interested in these backstage, you know, back of the bus conversations between two lead singers, please tell your friend, and hopefully you can continue to help this podcast grow. And I mean, the fact that we have Dennis this week for me is just such a victory. We've come so far. And I just, man, like, what are we, 42 episodes in? This is just like so much fun for me. So thanks to everybody for the support and listening to this. In other news, Silverstein, we're going on tour with Memphis May Fire and The Devil Wears Prada. And this tour is kind of hitting all of America and most of Europe and the UK. So I can't say the UK is Europe anymore, can I? That sucks, but hey. So check that out. That's going to be a really, really fun tour. Also, I got big announcements too. River Oaks, I'm doing more and more stuff with that. So keep your ear to the ground. And yeah, it's going to be a very busy end of the year for me, but I'm really, really excited. Anyways, I've rambled on enough. Let's get to the good stuff. Here's my conversation with Dennis Lixon of Refused.
Can I scream?
I guess we'll get started.
Yes. Let's do it.
I'm here in the back lounge of the bus.
Yeah.
With Dennis Lixon of Refused. How you doing today?
Good. Doing really good.
Great, man. Last day of the tour.
Yeah.
And you're headed back to Sweden?
Yeah. Tomorrow afternoon.
Nice. It's funny. I'm actually flying out from the airport right here in just a few hours.
Oh, wow. Where
we're
are you going?
We're going to Australia.
Wow.
So that'll
good
be...
Good for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of nice. I mean... Right now it's like pouring rain. People can't see, but it's like not a nice day. So I'm looking forward to
Australia.
Maybe
great.
Actually less hot weather, because here it's been crazy.
Yes, it's a bit disgusting.
Have you guys done a bunch of shows in Canada or just
no? This is the one,
the only one.
Yeah, the only one. It's been on the East Coast of America.
Nice.
Of USA actually.
USA. Yes. Yeah. Yes. how do you feel now? Like doing these? Like, has this tour long?
No, 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
When we got back together, well, not when we got back together, when we decided that we're going to continue after 2012, one of the things with people's life is that we decided to do 2 weeks, and then that's it, and then 3 weeks, a month off, and then 2 weeks, and then two, you know. So it's like Matthias and Magnus, they both have two kids.
Yeah.
Chris is an opera director.
Right. Yeah.
David writes music for other people. I have another band. So it's like it's pretty good to do like 2 weeks, and really when you're here you're really into it and it's fun and exciting. And then also the physicality of the way we play is especially me and David, it's 2 weeks and then then I'm pretty done after 2 weeks.
I get it. No, well, it's funny, I walk on your bus and I was like, damn, it's like it smells good in here and it's clean. And you're like, it's the last show of the tour, and I'm thinking to myself like, wow, these, like, that's kind of impressive, but I guess only 2 weeks.
Yeah, you know, that only makes 2 weeks sense. And also we have a four women on the bus, so I think
that helps
to keep the level up of everything, actually. Yeah.
That's great. You have four women working for you, or you have
no, four women working for us.
That's awesome, because it's, you know, as you guys know very well, this is a male-dominated world.
Yes, it is.
Is it important for you guys to try to hire females?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it's important for us to try to live by the stuff that we talk about. We talk a lot about gender issues and feminism and stuff like that. And then in 2012, when we're getting back together for the first time, there's all this discussion about, like, the crew and the people that you're going to work with. And dudes tend to hire dudes, and men tend to work with men. And someone just said, wait, there has to be women working in this, you know, the music business. So, music industry. And then, so we were lucky. I mean, we have three people that always was three women. And then the bus driver this time around is a woman. So
wow. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen that before.
Oh, she's rad. She's been driving for 25 years.
And crazy.
I've been sleeping, which is rare for me on the bus. So
yeah.
It's been good. No, we try to bring women on tour. Also, when we tour by ourselves, we always try to bring support band that have women in them just to... I mean, it's like a subtle point of showing that it doesn't have to be a boys' club.
Right.
So just like the small things that you can do to show some sort of gender equality in practice, not only in the way you speak and
absolutely
the way you talk.
No,
so
that's awesome about you guys, and something I respect a lot. So you've talked already about the reunion in 2012. A couple times you brought it up.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a 14-year break.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you guys were not together. You guys were playing... I think everyone was still playing music in some capacity. I mean, obviously, David was.
David was,
you
and
were.
I was. But Chris wasn't at all. Like, I don't think he'd play guitar in almost 10 years.
Wow.
And,
he never even touched a guitar?
Like, I mean, I'm sure he touched it, but he didn't play. I mean, he wasn't in any bands. And
yeah.
I mean, both Chris and John... that's not in the band anymore, they hadn't been on a stage since like we broke up in 98 until right. we played like the first couple of shows in 2012. They hadn't been on a stage.
It's crazy. So what, how did that all come together? Like, you guys, I understand it was a pretty messy breakup in 98.
Yes, to and say
I,
the least.
And I don't know if you want to talk about what happened.
Hey, we can talk about everything now.
Sure. I yeah. mean, yeah, like what happened in 98?
I mean, there's a lot of factors. And you can see part of it's in the movie that we that Chris right. made. I think
Refused Our Fucking Dead.
Refused yeah. Our Fucking Dead. I
People
think
check it out.
One of the things that we got burned out from touring. We don't talk about that much in the movie, but it's one of those things where looking back at it, like we never toured before. We didn't know how to tour. And like just the pace that we had and Refused was our life, like 24/7, 365 days a year. It was all about Refused. And at the tail end of that, we didn't like each other, which yeah. A lot of it, I think, stems down to the fact that we didn't like ourselves or who we became. And when we did the Shape of Punk to Come, it wasn't a pleasurable experience. It was kind of a drag, and we were fighting a lot about the direction we wanted the band to go in. And
yeah.
I think we had different ideas about what we wanted with music. So when we started touring, also I think one of the aspects is like we started touring in 1998. We put the record out, we started touring, and we didn't nail it. You know what I mean? We went out and yeah. we played kind of sloppy, and we hadn't practiced as much as we wanted to, and it was pretty bad for our self-confidence. And we peaked as a band in like in the 90s. People liked us. 96, that was like a good year. So when we came out in 98, it's weird, but yeah. when we came out in 98, the hardcore scene wasn't that excited about Shape of Punk to Come.
Yeah.
There's less people at the shows, and we were fighting within the band, and
crazy.
We had different directions that we wanted to go, and then we broke up.
So you didn't, when you made that record, you didn't even really think it was anything special? Or, like, did you know it was something special?
I mean, I'm very much a product of growing up in the north of Sweden. I remember telling David, we had a listening party at home. We had like a release party for the record in our hometown. And I remember telling David, I'm like, yeah, people are not going to get this record. People are not going to like it.
Sure.
And David's like, no, it's a great record. But I think because everything was so confined to scenes and like
yeah.
the hardcore scene, there's aspects of it that I love. But being open-minded is not one of the things that hardcore scene kind of excels in. So when we came out with a very different record, and it's a very pretentious record, I'm not going to lie. It's kind of like, you know,
I wouldn't say that to you.
Yeah,
you
no,
can say
no,
it to me.
You can say it is a very pretentious record in both good and bad ways. But I think a lot of hardcore kids, when that came out, they were just like, yeah, we're not interested. We moved
right.
on. And we felt that. And since we were so affiliated with the with hardcore and that scene, it was kind of a letdown for us. We were like, wow, we put out this record with this music that we put a lot of like
yeah.
work into, and no one cared. And
crazy.
We broke up. And
it's so crazy.
Yeah, and the tours that we did, we played a bunch of shows on that record because we did like two European tours. We did like a bunch of shows. We did like 45 shows in Scandinavia. And it was like, you know, when you come out and it's like, it's not as good as it was 2 years ago.
Crazy.
People are not as excited.
So
when we broke up, it was like very much in the spirit of a total defeat. You know, like we
nuts.
Broke up and we were just like, yeah, no one. This
yeah.
this kind of all went to hell. And I went home and I sulked around for like a week and I started Noise Conspiracy and we started practicing and writing songs and we went into the studio pretty quickly and while in the studio recording our first recordings. People kept calling me from America. They're like, they're showing your video on MTV. Like, people are going crazy.
Right.
Refused. I'm like, but we just broke up. And then we had to live with that for like a long time that we went out and played shows with like Noise Conspiracy. People like, I love Refused.
Right.
I'm like,
and then you have to tell people it's not the same band.
Yeah, I'm like, it's
band.
Not the same band. I'm like,
yeah.
we broke up and we just played a great show. And they were like, yeah, it was good, but I love Refused. So it was a weird time.
It's so weird. Well, I remember the first time. It's interesting you talk about the hardcore scene and stuff. The first time I heard Shape of Punk to Come, I'll never forget. I was in a record store, like an HMV. You know they used to have those
yeah,
CD
yeah.
listing booths or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
So I look at this and I go, okay, well, Shape of Punk to come. Well, I better check out what's coming, right? So I put on the headphones and I was like, because, you know, I was 17 and it was on Epitaph.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, oh, it's going to be like No Effects or Bad Religion or something like that.
No, no.
And I was like, and it starts and I'm like, is this even punk? Like, this is like kind of metal-y and kind of like, and I just didn't know what to think. And I heard the first song. I was like, I got to keep listening to this. And I don't know how much of the record I listened to just in the store, but a lot of it.
Yeah.
And was like, this record is, this is incredible. And the two things that strike me about that is the first is that Epitaph didn't have any bands like you guys.
No, not
so
at the
all
time,
the people,
no.
So you talk about hardcore scene being open-minded. Well, it was like you guys were trying to be promoted to the punk scene, like the skate punk kids, not like what Victory Records was doing at the time, which I know you guys were on for a while.
Yes.
Like it was a different kind of, you know, a scene, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
So that was like really interesting, and I don't know how that was for you guys.
It was kind of weird because we when we first came out as a band, a lot of our contemporaries, they were bands like Snapcase and Strife and Damnation AD, or, you know, bands that were on like the more of the Victory type of hardcore. And we put out like two records on Victory. And our first US tour was with Snapcase, of course, in 96. And then what happened was that we got signed to Burning Heart Records in Scandinavia and Europe, actually. And Burning Heart and Epitaph kind of merged.
Yeah.
So that's how we ended up on Epitaph. And
right.
I think, as you said, like, it was an astute observation. They didn't really have any bands like us. And we ended up there by default. And I think when Shape of Punk to Come came out, it was, I don't think anyone expected anything from it. I think people were just like, Epitaph and Burning Heart was like, yeah, we'll put
Epitaph
it out.
Was just like, I have to put
this
out.
Yeah, we'll put it out because it's a part of like the, you know, the bands that we're putting out. And
so did you ever have any contact with Epitaph, with like Brett Gurewitz and all that? I mean, you must have later on.
Later
but,
on.
But probably initially
that,
not really.
At that point, no, not really. I mean, the record came out, I think it came out in America like the week we broke up.
Crazy.
Yeah. So, but then, I mean, Noise Conspiracy ended up on Epitaph, and I have a great relationship with Brett and all those people now, but it was definitely a weird thing for us because, as you said, it came out on like a punk label, which we didn't really mind because I think in our minds, for us, cause we came from a time when hardcore was hardcore punk.
Yeah.
So for us, it made a little bit of sense, but it was definitely like also one of those things for us. Because we were on Victory for a while, and all those bands that we played with, like musically, like we fit with those bands, but politically we didn't fit at all. So we ended up being one of those bands that I remember when we toured with Snapcase, because the punk kids that we kind of could relate to, because there was this in the 90s, there was this whole scene with Heart Attack and Abolition and all those like really noisy political labels out on the West Coast that we really liked, but they hated us because we were on Victory, and all the Victory bands hated us because we were so outspoken political.
Right.
So you're one of those bands that just like we didn't really fit anywhere.
Yeah,
and it was kind of frustrating, but also I guess that speaks to the kind of people that we are, I guess.
Well, you talk about Shape of Punk to Come being pretentious.
Yes.
And, I mean, you can just look right at the fucking title.
Yeah.
The title itself is, you know, you could call that pretentious in that it's like you guys are making some kind of bold prediction, or that you guys are going to influence the next generation and stuff. And it comes off, it's a cocky title.
Yes.
But the fucked up part is now 14 years later, or sorry, not 14 years later.
It's, I don't even know how many years later.
Yeah, 18 years
98.
Later.
98. Yes.
The funny part is that you guys were kind of right.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is, like, you know, the punk rock, like the skate punk and all that stuff that came, that kind of faded away, and then it became more aggressive, screaming. You know, that stuff did become what punk rock is, you know, became. And you look at something mainstream like the Warped Tour, a lot of bands on that now that are, you know, punk bands are, like, not really...
No,
you know,
not
they're
punk
more
in the
influenced
classical
by you
sense.
Guys.
Yeah.
So when you came up with that title, what did that title kind of mean? And like, what did like? How did you know that was going to happen?
We didn't know that. what it was that what I talked about, like when we were in the States on tour with Snapcase, like we play with all these like metalcore kind of type of bands, and we couldn't relate to them because they were like not into politics and they were just kind of jocks, but like,
yeah,
they're like, I'm also straight edge, you're straight edge, we're all straight edge, and I'm like, but I am a communist. Well, they didn't like that at all. So when we came home from that tour, we were kind of fed up with the hardcore scene, we're kind of fed up with the punk scene, and we were just like, I don't think there was it wasn't like a you know, like, okay, let's predict the future, this is going to be the shit, because it was more like fuck you,
right.
That's what it was. The title was a complete, sure, like fuck you, like we'll name it Shape of Punk, come, we'll do something completely different. It's like fuck you and fuck your petty narrow-minded scene, fuck you and fuck your petty narrow-minded scene. That's what it was. And I mean we stole the title from Ornette Coleman's Shape of Jassicum.
Yeah.
And when that came out, people were like, that guy's an idiot. And then a couple years later, we were like, yeah, he was kind of right. And so it's like a funny, weird, because it wasn't, when you play music and when you write, it's always in the moment. And he wasn't, were you young kids? I was like 25 when we wrote that record. I was like the old guy in the band. I was 25. Yeah. And David was 22 and we were young kids. And it wasn't meant to be a legacy. It wasn't meant to be our lives. It was just a record. You know what I mean?
Right.
We just did a record and like, fuck you. And then the record came out, we broke up, and here we are almost 20 years later talking about it. It's pretty insane because it wasn't,
it's pretty insane.
Yeah. And I mean, when I got into music, it's funny, me and David talked about this the other day. David was one of those kids that was a super talented drummer, obviously, and he was destined for some sort of musical greatness, because he was like, when he was 13 years old, he was like a kick-ass drummer, and I was one of those kids that just like, I wanted to play music because I had so much energy within me, and I like so much frustration that music was like an outlet. And when I started playing music, there wasn't a single bone in my body that felt like, oh, this is going to be a career. I got into punk and I was like,
yeah,
this is perfect. I'll do this for a couple of years. I try to get my shit together. So even when we had Refused, it was like this weird like respite in life. We're like, okay, we'll do this. And then something else, I guess, like go to school or get a job. And then when Refused broke up, I didn't see myself as a musician. I was just like this punk guy.
Right.
And it took me a long time to come to terms with the fact that, oh yeah, I'm a musician.
Professional musician.
I'm a professional.
This is how I make money.
It's super weird, but it happened. But David was one of those guys that could have been like a jazz drummer, and he went and he saw, I had a hardcore band before Refuse called Step Forward, and he went and saw us play it. He was actually there to see another band, like a proggy like rock band, and he saw Refuse, Step Forward play, and he was like, shit, this is what I want to do.
Right.
So it's kind of crazy that
you kind of
perverted him
yeah.
to become this like this musician that he is today. But
do you think growing up where you grew up, what's the name of the city?
Umeå.
Yeah, I can't pronounce that.
No.
Umeå.
Yeah.
Okay, and that is very like, people probably don't know, it's in the northern part of Sweden. Like, how many hours from Stockholm is that?
Like 8 hours.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
driving 8 hours.
It's a long
way.
I mean, how much of growing up there factored into, like, a couple things? Like, there must have not been very much to do.
No.
And I can always relate this to Canada, too, because it's so fucking cold. Canada and Sweden.
Yeah.
Coldest countries. I always think, like, there's so many good, like, metal bands and stuff from Montreal, because I think those guys just stay inside all winter practicing guitar because they can't do anything.
Yes.
So there's that I think, I don't know if that factored into you guys, you know, becoming such a great band and so talented. Also, you guys not thinking anything was going to amount to it, because had anything ever come out of your town? I mean, Meshuggah, but other than that, like, they were probably the heroes.
Yeah, I mean, they were. We always made fun of them because they were like a couple years older than us, and they were like metal guys. But they were definitely like inspiration, because we were like, oh shit, band from our hometown that put out a record. And but yeah, I mean, isolation, boredom, you just never discount those things for creativity. And
yeah, it's amazing.
One of the things that also, because of the isolation, because of the boredom, there wasn't anything to do. Like, people, they played hockey or football.
Sure.
Or
yeah.
Hockey in the winter, football
in
the
summer. Fan later on, yeah.
And then, or they studied, or you were like the weirdo, which of course I was. So I started playing music, and the idea that you could just focus on your music, it wasn't like in London or Stockholm or New York, where there's like a scene where people are cool and you got the right attire, you got the right attitude. Like, we didn't have any of that. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing.
Sure.
And it's quite liberating to grow up somewhere where you can set your own standards and your own rules for what you want things to mean and what you want to accomplish. So I think that meant a lot for us. I mean, I think there's a couple of things that, as a human, there are certain things in life that will define you forever, and one of them is definitely growing up in an isolated part in the north of Sweden.
Yeah,
that's always going to define me culturally and socially, and like the human that I became. So yeah, I think it's super important.
Right, absolutely. This is, the podcast is called the Lead Singer Syndrome Podcast. If you didn't know, so
I knew that.
We talk about and it's a ridiculous title, but we talk about a lot of stuff like singing and stuff and all that and writing and everything. But one thing I want to talk about you that doesn't get talked about a lot on the show is just the whole idea of like stage presence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been called the Mick Jagger of punk rock. You know, you were. How was it being the L Sweden L Magazine 2004 Sexiest Man in Sweden?
Yeah, amazing.
Like, how fucking weird was that?
That was super weird. They called me and they said, we're doing this piece about the Man of the Year. I'm like, Man of the Year? I'm like, that's insane. And I went down to Stockholm. They're like, no, it's actually Sexiest Man of the Year. I'm like, what? They're like, we knew you wouldn't have come if we told you. I'm like, what? That's so crazy.
They duped you.
Yeah, they duped me.
That's funny. Yeah, you'd think it would be some like hockey player or some like mainstream.
Well,
you know?
Well, Zlatan Ibrahimovic was in second place. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, but that just the whole like your whole persona and everything. Like, you're such a dynamic frontman performing. Deer in the headlights. I love that.
Yeah.
Who was that walked in?
That was Don, our sound guy.
Nice. Yeah. You're such a dynamic frontman. Where did you get the influence to do that? Because you talk about how you didn't really know what you fuck you were doing, but then you come out and you're like Mick Jagger up there. So like, how did that come about?
First of all, when we started playing punk rock music and hardcore music, there was a. It's hard to describe, but no one. When I got into punk, I got into punk in 1987, and I started my first punk band then. And then in 1989,
what
I started
was your
my
first punk band called.
Well, called Afro Jets.
Afro Jets.
It's
okay.
Just ridiculous. And then my first hardcore band was called Step Forward, and we started in 1989.
Yep.
For the first band, I played bass and sang because no one else wanted to sing. And then when we started Step Forward, I was just a singer. And one of the things, like, here's, you have to understand, like, I lived in a small village outside of Umeå. Umeå is, at that point, maybe 90,000 people, and I lived in the village outside of it.
Yeah.
So I forced three other people to play hardcore music. And I don't know, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, like, how you discover hardcore music, because I was kind of a metalhead. I got into punk, and then I got into hardcore, and if we played a show in Umeå in front of 100 people, no one have heard hardcore before. It's that crazy. Like, people have heard the Ramones and the Pistols and like punk stuff, but as far as hardcore music, yeah, people didn't know. So the first show we played with Step Forward, we said, all right, so no one's gonna really understand what we're doing, so let's just fucking go crazy. And I remember, like, cause, and we had no point of reference but pictures of other records. Never seen a hardcore band live. Never seen a video of a hardcore band play.
Wow.
It was just like, we saw pictures on records, and I guess you got to jump.
Right, guys are X'd up on their, like, the back cover. Like,
yeah, so we just saw the pictures, and we're like, guess that's how you got to behave. So
that's amazing.
Our first show, we just went crazy. We smashed the guitar. The show ended with our drummer taking the cymbal stand and threw it in the fuse box. The whole place went dark. And people like, holy shit, those guys are crazy. And that just kind of stuck with me. And like, this idea that if people don't know what you're doing, just let them be entertained. And I think that hardcore and punk, when it came out, it was such an extrovert force. It was very inclusive. It was like, my whole idea has always been like, you hear the first chorus, and when the second chorus comes, you can sing along because it's that simple. And yeah, I always had this idea in the back of my mind that it's supposed to be inclusive. It's supposed to be like everybody can get involved in this. And then when we started Refused, because David and Chris, they're such great musicians, I think a lot of me just going crazy and doing my weird dances and stuff was just me covering up for the lack of my singing abilities for a while. I mean, I was like, I was a great frontman. I was not a good singer at that point because I wasn't.
People have said that before on the show,
yeah,
too.
And I kind of covered that up by being like this crazy extrovert person.
Yeah.
And then one thing that happened that I think really defined the stage persona that I am is that when I got into hardcore punk, and then when hardcore became popular, popular is a matter of definition, I guess, but when they started showing like Sick of It All and Biohazard on MTV, everybody was really tough. Yeah. There was a lot of guys with their shirts off just being tough.
Yeah.
And I could never relate to that because I'm not a tough person. I'm just like, I grew up in a small town in the north of Sweden. I'm not like a tough guy. I've been in a fight in my entire life. And so I think that really affected my persona because for like a week I try to take my shirt off and be like, yo, come on, do the whole like. And then I was like, that's not me. That's not who I am. And then The point of reference being like, you started like, I was in early into soul music. I was early into like, you know, like the Stones or Iggy. I saw Iggy Pop live 1990, and I was like, wait, that's the type of performer I can be. And then the contrast between like the really aggressive, violent music that Refuse played and me like in a suit, like kind of dancing. And I liked that contrast because it was something really different from like the guy in shorts and a baseball cap just kind of screaming. Yeah. So I was like, no, I want to be a performer. I mean, I love James Brown. I love Mick Jagger or Iggy you know, all those people. And I kind of just took that into who I am because that made more sense. Like, I could relate more to Iggy than to, you know, I love Sick of It All, but it wasn't like, sure. I wasn't from the Queens. I wasn't like a New York tough guy. So I could relate more to someone like Iggy. So that just became something that I brought with me. Yeah.
No, that's awesome, man. I guess like singing wise too, like I go back to the story I told you about hearing, you know, the record for the first time, and I gotta say, like, I don't think I would have ever started screaming if it wasn't for you. So obviously, like, you know, Shape of Punk to Come and then the earlier records that I heard afterwards, they inspired me to become a screamer, whereas before I just was like a good, you know, playing skate punk, you know, and playing guitars. So that really like opened up a whole new thing. Now, how much of that influence that you have for obviously not just me but many bands, do you ever think about that? Do you care about that? And the last question is, does it ever piss you off when like did you ever see Crazy Town cover New Noise? Like, shit like that?
That's a whole different question.
Okay, well, two part of that. Start with the first half of the question.
I wasn't, when I started playing hardcore punk, I was also more like, it was more like Minor Threat, 7 Seconds, so kind of like shouting.
Yeah.
You know, just more shouting. And then I remember we did the first Refused EP, and the producer, this guy Pelle, he was like, just scream, just fucking scream your head off. And I'm like, okay, because I was into the shouting, like the like that kind of
like the Little Biscuits, Minor Threat, all those bands were they weren't really screaming.
No, they were
different.
More like, it's a weird version of like singing / shouting. But Pelly just told me, just scream, like just fucking balls out screaming. So he pushed me really hard. We did the first EP, and then that just became my style of yeah. like how I related to Refuse by that just weird screaming part. And it also, it was weird because I think I was an okay shouter. I was just pretty good at like the shout singing kind of thing. But then I lost confidence in that because Refuse was so much about like the screaming thing. That was interesting. And then when Refuse broke up, I wasn't interested in screaming anymore. I was like, I'm done screaming. I don't want to scream. So we started Noise Conspiracy,
yeah.
like really taking two steps back and like kind of learn how to sing again. And now with doing Noise Conspiracy and Invasion and all of the other bands I've been doing in the interim between, like, just made me a good singer. And then to be able to complement that with screaming,
sure,
it's quite interesting because it gives you a good range of how you can use your voice live. Because I remember like the singing parts when we toured 98, the singing parts were kind of always a little bit off because I was really insecure about it.
Yeah.
But then the screaming parts would, you know, nail those. And now it's like I go pretty flawlessly from like singing to screaming, back to screaming, singing. I mean,
yeah.
And it's just like a matter of like how you use your voice and what you want to do with it. But it's something about Refuse, like the energy that brings out this primal,
yeah,
sort of screaming part. Then about Crazy Town. No, I don't.
For anyone that doesn't know, they're You're My Butterfly, Sugar, Baby. Yeah, they're that
thing. I don't really care that much. It's more like when you come out, there's like this really hardcore commie situation. It's like juggernaut of power.
Yes.
And then someone misunderstands everything that you're about.
Right.
That just like, I'm like, that's kind of a bummer because what? But in hindsight, it's quite entertaining that shit like that happens. Which is,
yeah,
I guess it's like, it's like in a backwards sort of way, it's just a compliment to the power of the music. I mean, yes, yeah, they misunderstood everything. Like, honestly, from A to Z, everything. But it's still kind of like, I mean, yeah, I guess they like the riff or something, but
yeah,
it's quite interesting.
It's a great riff, but I mean, there's Paramore too. The Paramore thing, do you know about that?
Yeah. They actually asked us.
I'm sure they did.
I
mean, that's like obvious.
Yeah, they asked if they could. There's like a guitar part that's very similar, and we're like, yeah, whatever. I think music is free. Music is like, yeah. Art is inspiration. You steal stuff, and I mean, we could, maybe that's a different pod with just sit with David and Chris and just ask the inspirations for all these weird riffs.
Oh yeah,
and it's like David said the other day, yeah, that's the Eric Dolphy piano line that we just stole for that riff, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's true. So it's like,
I mean, you steal a riff and you play it backwards. I mean, it's this,
like
people listening, it's like everybody does that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a great part of art, that it's like a free flow of information and ideas, and you hear something, you're like, holy shit, that's rad.
Yeah.
I want to do something similar. And then you take that idea, and then at first, it's quite obvious that you're stealing it. But then as you gain your own identity, then you can't really tell that much anymore. I mean, I think that happens. I mean, the first Refuse show we played, I think we played 4 Gorilla Biscuit songs. You know what I mean?
That's, it's like, right.
Yeah,
well,
that's where you start, and then
yeah,
we end up here, and it's a completely different song. But then when I saw Walter from Gorilla Biscuit, I actually saw Gorilla Biscuits the other night. I'm like, holy shit, this is where, you know, like, this is where Refuse started, like, with a couple of these songs.
Yeah.
So it's...
That's very cool.
Yeah. It's it's how life
that's
is.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, hey, you guys are back. It's been a very long hiatus. Well, I mean, the first one, anyways,
yeah,
from 98 to 2010 or 2012. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
In 2010, I know you guys posted up on your website like a coming soon thing, which was
it's like, oh, I don't know, another deluxe version of a record or
right,
something.
Like I don't even know how many they've you know, shit out at this point.
No,
now
I lost track
at that
as well.
Because there was speculation at that point that there was going to be a reunion. What was there? Going
no.
to be a reunion at that point, or did
no.
this sort of trigger it?
No, I think that was just like you know, the rumor mill started get going, and then I think that's exactly what Epitaph wanted. They were like, do you know, want the excitement, and then, no, it's just another version of the record. I think it was like that when they put out, like, maybe the double LP version of Shape.
Yeah.
No, I mean, me and David, I mean, we had a huge falling out in 98. Like, and we started the band, and we were, like, brothers in arms, and then at one point, like, we're not. We looked at each other and we're like, I can't relate to that person. And I think we both felt that. Yeah. And then, so we had a huge falling out. And then, you know, it took a couple of years of not being in touch when we sat down one day and we talked about life and music and why we like each other. And then, I don't know, 2006 maybe, we started a band called AC4.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we wanted to play together again. And I mean, he helped me out with some projects and we kind of drifted on and off into our lives. And we did AC4 together because we wanted to play music. Play hardcore, actually. And David and Chris has always been in touch.
Yeah.
David and Yoon's always been in touch. So it's like one of those deals where David's always been the guy that's been in touch with everyone and always like been hanging out with everyone. And then what happened in 2011, I would say, is that everybody lived in Umeå for the first time since we broke up the band. And it was like one of those things where like Chris lived in the States and he lived in Madrid and he lived in Stockholm. David lived in Stockholm. And, you know, it was like all of a sudden we all in the same city. And David's doing music with everyone in different projects. And then David, Chris came back to Umeå, like a relationship that ended or something, and he came back to him and was bummed out, and David gave him a guitar. He said, you need to play some guitar. And then a month later, Chris called him and was like, I'm coming out to your house, like, I got a riff. And David was like, alright. And then he showed him the riff and he said, because David was playing guitar at the time, playing guitar and singing, and Chris said, like, you play the drums. David was like, I haven't played drums in like 10 years, and that was Elektra.
Yeah.
And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, Chris showed the riff, and Dave was like, whoa, I think Chris is back. Like, whoa. Yeah. And then they started the band. Chris, David, and Magnus started an instrumental, prog, Steve Reich, kind of like weird metal band.
Yeah.
And so they had that going. Me and Dave were playing with AC4 together. And we got another, I mean, we got the offer from Coachella a couple of times, but then we got another offer from Coachella. And I think what it was, like, we were living in the same city. No one had anything really going on at the point. I mean, I was playing with my band Invasion, but it wasn't like, that wasn't full time. And everyone's just kind of waiting for something to happen. And we got the offer and got an email from our manager guy. And he's like, this is how we can do it. We could set it up like this, do Coachella and do a bunch of touring around it, maybe do like 10 festivals. And Davey called me and he said, don't talk to the other guys, just let everyone
think about it,
let it sink in. And then and I forgot about it because we had, I mean, David talked about it a couple of times, like, how would it be, could we do it, blah blah blah. And then so I forgot about it, and then David called me like 3 weeks later, and he's like, we're doing it. I'm like, what do you mean doing it? We're like, hey, we're doing it. And I'm like, you sure when we get together and practice, like, he'll be fine, let's do it. And that was it. And then we decided to do it. And I mean, then
how much of that was driven by the excitement for the music and playing together? And there must have been a lot of it just be like, whoa, Coachella's paying us how much money? Like, we
kind of
have to do this. Like, is it because, I mean, you're older, you got families and shit, like.
Yeah, but I think the financial incentive was never the reason. Because we got the offer before. We got a lot of offers before. But you're always like, no, we're not interested. I think the idea was, can we do it? And how can we do it? And then the fact that they offered us a lot of money, it was like, if they didn't offer us the money, I don't think we could have done it. Because it enabled us to, like, okay, let's take time out just to do this. We took 2 months out of our lives just to practice because we could afford to. And, I mean, a lot of bands, they get back together, like, oh, we practiced 3 times. We haven't played in, like, 8 years.
Yeah.
We practiced every day for 2 months, 8 hours a day. And that's, I mean, yeah. just because someone was generous enough to give us this offer. But it wasn't like about the money. I mean, the money is, it's nice.
How much of this goes to taxes anyways?
Well, a lot of it. But
we will get into that.
But. Yeah, that's also a different pot, I think. But it wasn't about that. It was about how can we do this? Can we do the music justice? And we started practicing, and our first idea was to do Coachella, maybe a couple of more, maybe do 8 shows.
Yeah.
That's it. We ended up doing 82 shows just because we had so much fun.
Awesome.
And it felt so good playing these songs, and they felt relevant, and we felt relevant. And like the second we got back together, we decided it's not nostalgia. It's just like, let's be who we are in 2012 and not try to emulate something we were back in 98, but let's actually set the template from who we are and what we are right now.
It must have been so crazy for you guys, though, when you got back together. And, like, Coachella is one thing, because that's, like, a festival, and that's just wild. But, like, when you were doing your first, like, headline show, where was that? Like, after Coachella? Because Coachella was the very first one back, right?
Well, we did...
Or was there a warm-up one, maybe?
3 warm-up shows. We did one in our hometown... We did one in Stockholm, and then we did one at the place called the Glass House in Pomona.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
The day before Coachella.
But like, those must have been the biggest shows Refuse had ever played.
I mean, sort of.
I guess those were small, like smaller venues. But then, I saw you play in Toronto at Sound Academy. You did 2 nights.
Yeah.
You know, like 2,500 sold out. Like,
yes.
You guys have never done that before.
No, never. You're not even close.
You're carrying like production now. You've got all this crew.
I know
from other bands, like from, you know, Noise Conspiracy. You know, got pretty big for a while.
Yeah.
And you know, I know you understand. You guys understand like the music industry and how this stuff works. But that must have been so weird.
I think it was weird for the other guys, as you said. Like, I did the bus tours with Noise Conspiracy. We had like a crew, and we did pretty good for a while.
Yeah.
I think it was weirder for the other guys because, I remember we had the first meeting, and even, like, the first meeting, like, the people in the band were just like, wait, are we staying at hotels? What the fuck are you talking about? Like, why are we staying at hotels? We can stay at people's houses. I'm like, no, we should stay at hotels. And there was, like, this whole idea about how you tour, because that's the only way a lot of these people knew how to tour. But yeah, I think the biggest difference, I mean, the posh aspects of it, that we have a crew now and we get to travel on a bus and some nights you get a hotel, as just like the silver lining. I think that the tricky part for us was how do you transform these songs from like basements and squats and like small dingy punk clubs to these big venues.
Yeah.
That was like the challenge. Because I remember that we played at the first show in Umeå was like a 250 capacity room, and was, I think we had a guest list of 200 people.
And
there's like 500 people outside, couldn't get in. And we're like, holy shit. And then we played in Stockholm, it was like 800 capacity, and I think 800 people couldn't get in. And then we played Glass Houses, also like 800 capacity. Which we'd done shows like that in the 90s, like the bigger clubs. And we'd done a couple of festivals in Sweden, but walking out on the stage at Coachella, I think it scared the shit out of all the other guys. I mean, I've done it. Noise Conspiracy actually played the main stage at Coachella once. So I was like, I kind of knew it, but it sounds different. The way you interact on stage is different because it's so much bigger. The monitor sounds different. The way everything is different. So the first week in Coachella was super shaky. It was like, what, can we really do this? Because there was no experience. But then in between, because Coachella's 2 weekends, and in between we played a show in San Francisco at the Warfield with the Bronx and the Hives.
Nice.
And we blew them out of the water. It's one of those shows where, like, I mean, they're fucking amazing bands.
Both bands are awesome.
Both bands are awesome, and both bands are like solid live bands. Yeah. Like, fucking crazy. And we just, they didn't stand a chance. They were fantastic.
But
it was one of those deals where it was like, we felt at that show, like, oh shit, we can actually pull this off.
Yeah.
And that was a big change, like, to be able to to perform these songs in an environment that wasn't like the punk rock environment where we try to perform them in the 90s. Cool. So that was a really
absolutely
big deal for us.
Do you ever see Noise Conspiracy coming back?
I mean, yeah, why not? I love that band, and
I mean, we're
still friends. And Sarah, that was in Noise Conspiracy, she plays in my other band. And
cool.
Inge, we talk a lot. He's home in Umeå, and I just spent New Year's with the drummer. So yeah,
cool.
Maybe one of these days.
Cool, man. Well, that would be great. That would be awesome. a couple more things. The book I read a long time ago by Chuck Klosterman, I'm sure you know it. It's called Killing Yourself to Live. Book. Basically, it's the whole premise of the book is that the best career move you can make is dying, right?
Yes, probably.
You know, and it's morbid, but it's probably true. And obviously, you know, none of you guys have died, but like, you know, you guys did have that catchphrase like "refused or fucking dead," you
yes.
know, and that became a thing. That became a thing when people would talk about refused. Be like, yeah, they're fucking broken up. They're never getting back together. You know, they broke up right after this amazing record came out. Like, all of a sudden, you guys are like fucking legends.
Yes.
Now, how much of that do you think factored into like your union being so big? And I guess the second part of the question is, if you guys had stayed together and rode that wave with MTV success and all that, do you think you guys could have been like? Like another Rage Against the Machine, you know, like on that level, like
no, maybe who knows?
It's, right.
You can only speculate and stuff like that. I'm glad we didn't. I'm glad we broke up, and it's one of those like blessings in disguise. I mean, at the point I was bummed, but I'm glad because I think the break gave us. The abilities to be the band that we should have been, or that we the best band that we could be. So I think that was a good thing. But yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe we could have been a hugely successful band. But I'm not. That was never really the ambition, though.
No, I know.
I'm quite happy with
especially. With I'm sure, and I'm probably putting words in your mouth, but like in 1998, you know, you called yourself like I was just a punk.
Yeah.
You said it took me a long time to understand this was a career.
Yeah.
So you guys probably would have pushed away a lot of that stuff at the time too.
Yeah. I mean, I was the guy in the band that come to practice. I listened to the riff and I said, "Yeah, I don't really care. Music is just a tool to." It's just a vehicle for the revolution, and then I left. So.
I love that.
Yeah, and it would have been. If we would have stayed together, it definitely would have clashed. Because I was so into the idea that the music in itself at that point wasn't that important. It was just like a vehicle for a revolution.
Right.
So I think that was, you know, we wouldn't have lasted. Like if the record came out and we were on MTV, we would have broken up immediately because someone would be like, "It's sell out to be on MTV."
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad we broke up before that. But the other part of the question, it's yes, we had a manifesto as well. I wrote the angry manifesto, and we had a song "Refuse to Fucking Dead," and it was like. The last show, like the cops came and shut us down. And the crowd was chanting like "Rather Be Alive."
I've heard the story about that.
Yeah, it was like a really perfect ending. And then Chris said one day, he's like, "People saying you're a legend doesn't really pay your rent." And I'm like, and he was like, "I had to pawn my guitar because I couldn't afford to eat." And then people, "You guys are legends." He's like, "That doesn't really matter." And I thought that was funny. I mean, I was playing music and I was doing my thing, but I definitely think the backstory helped create the mythology of Refused.
Because
so many people never had a chance to see us, and we became big, especially in America. Europe, it wasn't that big of a gap.
Yeah.
Like, but definitely in America, because we became this mythological, like, being almost like Refused, and then people just like, yeah, they're never gonna get back together. And I think that definitely added. I mean, you could have, but here's a funny story. When we announced in 2011 that we're going to get back together, people fucking... people went pretty mental over it. And I don't think we were fully prepared. I mean, I toured around the world, so I knew that people everywhere liked Refused.
Yeah.
But I was like, yeah, they like Refused. It's fine. But then the you know, like, here we are, we're back, and people fucking lost their minds.
Yes.
And I don't think we were quite prepared. So when we started practicing for months, we talked about, like, why is this? And we had this discussion about the mythology, like the breakup, the mysterious band that never, no one saw play, blah, blah, blah. And then someone said, maybe, though, people are this excited because it is a great record. And we're like, yeah, maybe that's also a part of... Because, I mean you can have all the mythology you want, but if you can't back it up with good tunes, it would just be something that drifts away and be written off in, like, the, you know, the annals of rock history and be like, oh, they were the cool band. But we that record that we put out resonated with a lot of people, and it was a record that... To this day, when we play these songs live, people fucking lose their minds and go fucking... every night we play New Noise, people fucking go crazy. I'm just like,
of course.
Still, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's just, I wanted to know how self-aware of that you are. Because sometimes you don't, you know, you're on the inside looking in, you're the guy, like, you don't really know. It's hard to understand, you know?
It took us all a long time, I think. I think for a long time we were... Refused was much more of an albatross than it was, you know, a blessing.
Yeah,
because it was so, like, weighing down on our other projects. And still to this day, it can still do that. I mean, I put out a record with Invasion 2 years ago, and people are like, yeah, it doesn't sound anything like Refused. I'm like, shit, man, it's like a completely different band. It's like, you know, it's recorded, written like 16 years after Shape of Punk to Come, and you're still gonna compare it. So it can still be sort of a bummer sometimes that it's always going to be compared to that.
Right.
But then, as I said earlier, discovering punk rock, being from the north of Sweden, Refused. 20 years from now, if Refused breaks up right now, 20 years from now when I do interviews, we'll still talk about Refused.
Yeah.
It's always going to define the person that I am and the way people perceive me. And for a long time, that was a bummer. But now I'm sort of, it's just a part of who I am.
Right. Well, two more questions, and I'll let you go.
Yes.
If you don't mind.
No.
The first one is the new record, Freedom.
Yes.
That must have been very challenging to try to write that record, because people are expecting a Refused record. They're expecting Shape of Punk to Come Part 2.
Sort of. Yeah.
And even if you wanted to give that to them, which it doesn't seem like you guys were trying to, how do you put yourself in that place you were in 1998 when you made that record?
Well,
like, what was your approach on the record?
The first of all, one of the things that we said from the get-go when we said we write new music, because I think we wanted, after 2012, we wanted to continue to be a band.
Yeah.
It felt important. It felt that the friendship had really, like, rekindled, and, like, the creativity of it. And the first thing we said is... we need new music. We're not going to be a nostalgia act,
because
that's not who we are. So the new music is rooted in who we are now, the people that we are, and our ideas of what we are. But also, one of the first things we said, like, we have to make a Refused record. So it's not, you know, we can't come out with some weird artsy-fartsy bullshit because that's what we're into right now. Like, it has to be a Refused record. But then when we start playing together, like, the way Chris writes the riffs and the way David plays the drums, the way I sing, it automatically becomes Refused. Even if it's a weird, not a weird song, but even if it's a song like Servants of Death, which is a weird, like, Prince homage, but it still kind of sounds like Refused. And I think that was a really important thing for us. And we knew getting into the trenches again with, like, writing new music and being a contemporary band. Yeah, Shape of Punk to Come, people had 14, 16 years to live with that record. No matter what we put out, it's going to be a tough fight, you know? It's going to be a tough sell, because people are just like, there's a time and place, like, you were 17-year-olds, you went to the record store, you listened to it, you're never going to have that experience again. And that's something that you have to fight with making new music. But on the other hand, it's like what we felt is like we want to be in control of the destiny of our band, and we want to be in control of the music that we create together. And we can't let the past stop us, because that would be defeatist to be like, oh yeah, we did that record already, so why bother?
Sure. I mean,
and we want to push ourselves. It's funny, like when we did ShipUp.com, we talked about that before, like we pushed ourselves, and a lot of hardcore kids was like, fuck these guys, they sold out, it's like pretentious record. And we did the exact same thing now that we did, and a lot of people like, fuck these guys, this doesn't sound like Refused anymore. I'm like, yeah, we just did exactly what we did in 1998.
You were as honest as you could be.
Yeah, it was honest as we could be, and just as creative and passionate as we could be, and just put everything into the record. Of course it was tricky. It was like, it's been 14, 15 years since we wrote music together. And that's a fucking lifetime, you know?
Now, do you have a new record planned?
Yes. We're going to continue to be a band. I mean, that's our ambition. It's not... not, like, soon.
Yeah.
But it's in the works. We have new riffs. We have new songs, new ideas, and...
new vehicles for the revolution, you mean?
Yes, we do. But I also think... Yeah, yes.
Well, I want to ask you... I'll cut you off right there, because we don't have much time, but, like... The whole idea of that, has that fallen by the wayside for you, or do you still feel as like politically charged and as important, is that as important to you as it all it's always been?
Yes. I mean, it's different because I'm not 25 anymore with like a newfound love of situationist sloganery, but I mean, if you look at Freedom, it's super political. Like every fucking phrase is like a political manifesto. Every night we play on tour with the Deftones. Every night I go up and talk about, like, Later Lee Kaplan, and talk about Donald Trump, and talk about feminism. Every night.
Yes.
Every night. Every interview we talk about politics. Yeah, it's still super important. It's definitely, I mean, two things. When we started writing political lyrics, it wasn't an image. It wasn't like someone sat down in the bedroom and be like, let's pretend to be Marxist. I'm sure we're going to sell tons of records. It was like, it's who we were at that time. And politics, when you're a young kid, comes more from the heart than from the intellect. It's more like the gut reaction to a fucked up world. That led us into like politics, more of the intellectual side, or not intellectual, but more, you know, actually reading about it and learning.
Yes.
And it's who we are as people. When me and David sit down and talk about lyrics, Freedom is what came out. Like, it's not like a post. And also the music that Refused creates, like the violence and the aggressiveness of it, there is a certain language and a certain way that it's very connected to the music.
Yeah.
So when I'm writing lyrics for Invasion, it could be different because it's a bit of a different feel to the music. But with the music that Refused puts out, it's very like clenched fist kind of attitude. And that really
inspires you.
Yeah, it inspires me.
So then I guess
it reflects.
The music is more important to you now than it was, because before you said you'd hear a riff, you'd be like, I don't really care.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
it's interesting.
That definitely changed. And I think for me now, the political aspect of it's super important still. And I still love the idea that as a band, it means more than just music. But the musical aspect of it is super important. Like the way we play together, the way we write together, and the way we try to push our boundaries and other people's perception of what we are. I love that. I love that whole idea. And I mean, any musical project that I'm involved in, I'm always trying to push myself. I think it definitely switched. I mean, I think you got to... Every reaction causes a counter reaction, and that's kind of how life is. And I mean... We made Freedom with a certain like idea of how we wanted it to be, not perceived, but how we wanted to do it.
Yep.
And it's very much a studio record. It's very much like you, we wrote it in secrecy, which is kind of interesting. You know, I lied to all my friends. I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna go hang out with them. And then we recorded it, and it's a very studio-esque sort of album.
Yeah,
playing these songs live has definitely taught us a lot about the writing process of it and what works live, because it's like sometimes you write a song and you think this is going to destroy, that room's going to be obliterated when we start playing a song, and you start playing and that nothing happens, you're like, oh wait, this is not at all. And then, you know, so I think taking that as like the, you know, the place where we start writing the next record.
Yeah,
it's going to be really interesting, because I think both Chris and David, when they started writing now, they were like really like inspired by what really works live, really, you know, connects with people. So it's going to be interesting.
Totally get that. Okay, cool. One last thing. I mean, you're 44.
Yes.
like, at this point, like, what do you feel like you've sacrificed? You know, I know you don't have a family. Do you want a family? Are you ever thinking about possibly running for some kind of, you know, political office?
Wow.
What's next for Dennis Lixon, I guess, you know? What's the future hold?
The future.
Besides the new Refused record, which is very exciting news.
Politics interests me only in as far as they can be art. I think that one of the things about being an artist and a musician is that you can exaggerate. You can really kind of go balls out,
yep,
so to speak. And I really love that concept of politics. But I'm not very interested in politics as a, like, you know, budget deficit and stuff like that. But I'm just interested in pushing the envelope and trying to come up with new thoughts and new ideas. So I don't think any, realistically, I would never be a good politician.
Yeah.
My ideas are way too far out, and I'm too much of like a romantic dreamer, and you can't really be that. I wouldn't be interested in compromising my thoughts to kind of like, so that would never happen. As far as what you sacrifice, it's like, yes, it is tricky to live like a normal life.
Yeah,
but I was never a normal person. I was never interested in the normality of, you know, like the, to like picket fence kind of life. So I don't feel I sacrifice. I mean, yeah, sometimes it's hard to have a relationship because people have a very, it's hard for people to understand what this life means if you're not a part of this life.
Yeah.
And it's like, people find it very interesting and intriguing until they realize, oh shit, that's actually how you live your life. I'm like, yeah, so that's a bit tricky, but most of my friends understand, and most of the people I hang out with, they know, I mean, they know I'll be gone for a couple of weeks, and then I call them up, I'm like, yeah, I'm home, let's hang out. So that's all right, I don't really mind that. I like, the older you get, the more different you become, I think, because when you're young, it's easy to be a rebel. It's easy to be like, people almost expect that from you. Like, yeah, let's go through the rebellious phase and then kind of get in line and do your shit. And the older you are, and the more you kind of, you know, you go your own way, and you kind of make up your own path. And I think that's very interesting. And I think that your life should be a work of art that you can look back at and be like, I held that line and I did what I wanted to do, and I true to myself. I mean, I had years where I've been fucking super broke and super bummed because nothing's really going as you want it to, and then I've had years when it's been fantastic. But it's all a part of an ongoing process. So yeah. And up and coming in my life, I have Ankle Invasion, and we just finished a new record that I'm gonna put out. The first single is gonna be out in September.
Awesome.
And back on the road.
What's the first single called? Is it out yet?
When's it
coming out?
It's coming out in Scandinavia in September. I think we might do it as a release all over the place because we don't have a record label outside of Scandinavia. Hint, hint. Anyone interested, give me a call. So it's called Imazu. It's German for forever. Okay. It's a, like a feminist, yeah, it's a full-on feminist attack. And,
all right, there you go.
Yeah, so that's my, the next year and a half, I think, going to be playing Touring with Invasion or Riding with Refused. And then the next year and a half of that is going to be touring with Refused and Riding with Invasion.
So, you're going to be a busy guy. Yeah. So the two week thing for Refused doesn't apply to Dennis
Invasion.
Lixon.
No,
that's just the other guys.
That's like the lamos of this band. No, it's the people with family. I get it. It's kind of nice. But no, for my life, that doesn't apply. I would do more if I was allowed.
Cool. Well, on this podcast, we always end with music every time.
All right.
So let's play an Invasion track, because I'm sure a lot of people that know Refuse, they might not have heard Invasion.
Oh, yeah. Do it.
So let's bust it out. Do you have a particular favorite? Not, like, the new single might not be out when
no,
this comes out.
Let's do a song called Down in the Shadows.
Dying in the Shadows?
Down.
Down in the Shadows?
Yeah, Dying in the Shadows, not bad either, but Down in the Shadows from a record that came out 2 years ago.
All right, yeah. Awesome. Well, here it is, Down in the Shadows,
the
Invasion.
Woo-hoo.
On Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. Thank you. Dennis, thank you
so much.
Thank
you. Thank you.